I really have to thank the organizers of this conference, primarily Ariana, for their very genuine generosity and hospitality. These are qualities which make the practice of interculturalism not just possible, but pleasurable. So I'm very happy to be here. I'd like to begin by teasing out some thoughts in the very construction of this conference's agenda. When we hear the word dance body, it appears to be a compound. We're not dealing with a dancing body, or dance and body, or dance beyond body. We hear one word, dance body. But when we see the words dance body, we realize that the compound is actually made up of two words which are divided or linked, not by a hyphen, but rather by a slash. And I would suggest that this slash is best read as a tangent. That point of contact between two surfaces which do not intersect. In this regard, the second part of our conference's title, focusing on the crossroads of culture, signifies an intersection. Crossroads go like this. Tangents go like this. So perhaps inadvertently, or maybe unconsciously, there are two modalities of movement which are embedded in our agenda, epitomized by a tangent and an intersection. So there are a lot of choreographic possibilities, I believe, in our thinking of the conference. The word tangent draws its etymological roots from the Latin tangentum, which is linked to tangere, which literally means to touch. It would be useful, I think, for us to reflect on the politics of touch in two different contexts. One is provided by Erin Manning in her formative book, The Politics of Touch, which straddles the worlds of dance and political philosophy. I realize that many of you may not have read the book. I'm not going to do a detailed reading of this philosophical book. I'm going to throw out some axiomatic positions provided by Erin Manning in the context of the conference. So that's one context. And the other context is provided by an interdisciplinary, site-specific public art project in Durban, South Africa, called Tangentia, which I had conceptualized as a dramaturg within the framework of a politics of touch. Now, it's very interesting. I was using this formulation of the politics of touch without having read Erin Manning's book. I've now read the book. And I realized there are very interesting overlaps between the projects, but also some very significant contextual and political differences. For a book so exploratory and open in its somatic thinking, the argument of Manning's The Politics of Touch nonetheless rests on some firm and non-negotiable axioms. She says, for instance, that there is no body that exists before it moves. There is no body that exists before it moves. While movement is obviously privileged in this epistemology of the body, we would need to question what kind of movement is being addressed. Is it a continuous movement, which has increasingly been subjected to deconstructionist critique by postmodern dance scholars? Or is it an interrupted, disjunctive movement, a movement that is arrested or which breaks down into what Andrei Lepecki highlights as still acts? In a very different cultural trajectory, going back many centuries, stillness has a different psychophysical significance in the corporeal language of Hatha Yoga. In my close interaction with the Indian dancer and choreographer Chandralekha, particularly during her rehearsals of a production entitled Prana, which means breath, in which the asanas of yoga are intersected with the adavus, the movements of Bharatanatyam, I learned from her that asanas are not virtuoso static poses or postures. Rather, they are circuits of energy in embodiments of stillness. For her, the most difficult of asanas was the shavasana, in which the body lies absolutely still on the back, hands on the side, in the figure of a corpse, literally a dead body. In this death of movement, there is inner movement through which the journey of the body continues. Returning to Manning's axiom that there is no body that exists before it moves, I would agree, so long as we're prepared to complicate our idea of movement in dance as something that incorporates stillness and breakdown. And let's not forget those states of incarceration and torture in the real world where bodies are not allowed to move at all. We're living in a world where there are many detention centers, there are many prisons, there are all kinds of torture cells. And in these cells, the inmates may not even be able to move their eyes. Okay? So in such scenarios, there's obviously no voluntarism or free agency, countering Manning's essentially liberal and pluralist assumptions that movement is always already available for bodies to exist. And I'm trying to say that may not be the case in many contexts and realities in the world. Another axiom provided by Manning. She says, there is no such thing as a body that is not relational. Now this resonates very sharply with the formulation of culture in one of my early essays. In this attempt I made in the essay to physicalize and ground the amorphous category of culture, I had suggested something very simple. I had said that culture is not just what exists in me or what exists in you. In other words, it's not just an internalization of deeply embedded inherited codes of self-understanding and socialization. Rather, I had suggested that culture is what could exist between me and you. And in this formulation, it becomes obvious that my reading of culture, like Manning's reading of the body, is essentially relational, intrinsically linked to at least one other body. To provide a metaphor for this relationality, I had invoked the domestic practice of making yogurt. Now, Cyprus is famous for its yogurt, but maybe we make yogurt differently, I don't know. In India, we make yogurt at home. Instead of buying it from the supermarket, we call it dahi. As some of you may be aware, the chemistry of making yogurt is facilitated through the insertion of a leftover, a trace, of yesterday's yogurt. This element, which curdles the milk into yogurt, is literally called culture, a catalytic and processual agency. So that's how I would like to see culture, and I fully agree with our friend from Spain. It's something that is linked to process. It's not something that's already fixed. Now, from the processual lessons drawn from her embodied practice of the tango, that's interesting that the tango lies is the practice that enables Erin Manning to philosophize movement. Manning highlights the crucial dynamics of relationality in terms of what she calls reaching towards. Quote, I reach not towards the you I ascertain, but towards the you you will become in relation to our exchange. Now this is a far more fluid understanding of me and you, as suggested in my more singular understanding of these terms, which were also implicitly culturalized. Later in the book, Manning reiterates, when I reach to touch you, I touch not the you, who is fixed in space as pre-orchestrated matter form, I touch the you that you will become in response to my reaching towards. It's not surprising that this assertively processual reading of bodies which are endlessly deferred should lead Manning to endorse Deleuze and Guattari's bodies without organs, which can never be reached because one is forever in the process of attaining such bodies, which represent a constantly elusive limit. Within the logic of a recurrent potentiality, therefore, Manning categorically asserts that, and listen to this, there is no identity to the bodies without organs. There is only movement. Now, I stress that because obviously this is a challenge to the very formulation of this conference, where identity is indeed so very categorical. How would I position myself to this? Well, I would say, while this rejection of identity, and not just identity politics, is obviously provocative, it also strikes me as being somewhat utopian in the context of the real world, and more specifically in the context of post-apartheid societies like South Africa, to which I would like to turn my attention now. What does it mean to touch in the context of post-apartheid public spaces? This was the central question underlying the diverse artistic interventions of the Tangentia project in Durban. I can't describe the project in detail, suffice to say that we had performances, installations, all kinds of sculptures which were located in different public spaces like public parks, community centers, museums, shopping malls, and by simply inserting our art in the public space, we realized how vulnerable our bodies were to attack or to certain kinds of violence. In the course of the project, quite a few of the artists were held up at gunpoint, and one of the sculptures in a taxi rank, well, all the materials were robbed on the first day and the guard was mugged. So there are real risks involved when you attempt to touch, you attempt to enter public spaces, you're not protected. Even as South Africa has formally disbanded the system of apartheid, the reality is that the residues of racial segregation continue to foment tension and violence. These are reinforced by the very topographies of social space, where entire communities, primarily poor and black, continue to live in the same townships determined by the segregationist laws of apartheid. So the constitution has changed. South Africa has the most glorious democratic constitution in the world, but people, especially poor blacks, are living exactly where they were during the apartheid era. Nothing has changed. So how, my question is, how does one touch the other in such a segregated topography? If the very structuring of social spaces continues to obstruct intimacies between strangers who continue to be haunted by the real specters of no man's lands and no-go zones. While I was working on Tangentia, there was a critical event that took place in a supermarket involving a South African Indian sales girl and a black male Zulu customer. It seems that while the customer was waiting for his change at the cash counter, the sales girl did not place the change in his outstretched palm, choosing, or was it her body that acted as a reflex, to place the change on the counter between them. This non-touch was interpreted by the Zulu man as a racial gesture. And it was not long before entire communities claiming to represent Zulus and Indians hurled accusations and counter-accusations against each other, contributing towards a nasty affirmation of mutually imbricated racism. So you can see how a very small incident, a very slight moment, can completely blow out of proportion. And I would tell you, never, never underestimate the little differences that fester between and across communities, because little differences can be explosive. If every touch in a post-apartheid space has the potentiality of becoming a blow, every non-touch also has the possibility of consolidating racist norms. In Manning's terminology, the sales girl's non-touch could be described as a manifestation of tact, which also emerges from the stem tangere to touch. According to Manning, quote, in its first definition, tact is touch. Yet something has occurred in time that has created an uncanny rift between tact and touch. Tact is interpreted as a certain prescience that keeps me from touch, from moving toward. Tact is knowing when not to touch. Very, very precisely formulated. Now, knowing when not to touch, knowing when to touch, this knowing, I would argue, is not just an individual response, but it is what I would call a deeply embedded habitus, to use Pierre Bourdieu's term, and I'm going to be talking about that at length. It's a condition that has been consolidated not just through the dictates of the state or through your education, but through the more immediate laws and dynamics and energies of community and caste. And I bring in caste because if you're dealing with a South African Indian sales girl, I do believe that her habitus has to a large extent been determined by caste. So keeping the phenomenon of caste in mind, specifically in countries like India, one needs to emphasize that entire histories encompassing several generations of inter-community taboos on social interaction have given shape to the differentiations of tact and touch. Their separation is not just an uncanny rift, as Manning emphasizes. It is deeply consolidated in the cultures of everyday life. Nowhere is this more palpable than in the stigmas relating to untouchability. Within Haddam's philosophy, Manning has a somewhat ethereal interpretation of untouchability when she says, quote, I am moved by you and I move with you, but I do not become you. You are untouchable. What I touch is that untouchability. Obviously, this is a different context and resonance of untouchability from the condition faced by millions, and I mean millions, of low-caste and outcast people in India, for whom the transgressions of touch are accompanied by the very real risks of abuse, ostracism, if not lynching. To this day, low-caste children in rural India are not allowed to drink water in school from the same tap out of fear that their touch will pollute the water. Touch is not just skin-to-skin contact. The accidental brushing of an untouchable's clothes can trigger a violent reaction. In the worst scenario, which might sound totally bizarre to you, even the shadow of an untouchable can be regarded as an inauspicious sign of pollution. So even shadows can touch. Even shadows have palpable reality. Now, to be clear, I'm not trying to say that this is the dominant reality of caste in all parts of India. Caste is a massively complex and mutant phenomenon. However, the point I'm trying to make is that the politicization of caste through Dalit ideology and the aggressive policy of reservations adopted by the state. Reservations are quotas. Quotas to get loans, quotas for employment, quotas for all kinds of opportunities, which the state makes available to millions and millions of low-caste people. Well, these reservations may have increased social and economic opportunities for the downtrodden, but they have not succeeded in circumventing the taboos of touch, which remain obstinately resilient to change in the cultures of everyday life. So I'm trying to say everything is not just within our control. It's not what we want to do. I want to touch you. I want to dance. I want to interact. Sorry. Sometimes there are all kinds of restraints, constraints, and certain kinds of inhibitions, prohibitions, taboos that are embedded in us. And we have to indeed take cognizance of that. Let us turn at this point to Bourdieu's concept of the habitus, which I will now relate to the bodies of dancers, and more specifically to the practice of improvisation. Manning ends her books in the words, "Let us improvise," by pleading strongly against the tendency in writing to submit to a stagnant humanist vocabulary. claiming that the politics of touch in her reading fights this impulse, she subscribes to the familiar associations of improvisation in terms of freedom, invention, and the pleasures of the unforeseen, a word derived from the Latin improvisus, to which improvisation is linked. In a related reading on improvisation, dance scholar Susan Foster specifically links the improvised to that which eludes history, an axiomatic position that compels her to ask, what would history look like if it were to acknowledge the fact of improvisation? To both Manning and Foster, Bourdieu would provide some startling complications to their assumptions. Listen carefully. For a start, far from rejecting history in relation to the body, Bourdieu would claim that the habitus is embodied history, internalized as a second nature and so forgotten as history. Embodied history internalized as a second nature and so forgotten as history. This is not just a history of words, of ideas, of ideology, which enables us to think, but it's a history that is catalyzed through what he calls a motor function that animates gestures and movements, a way of walking, a tilt of the head, facial expressions, ways of sitting, which constitute a language of the body, which he terms hexis. Actively resisting the charge of mechanical learning by trial and error, there have been a lot of critiques against Bourdieu's concept of habitus. People say, oh, it's too deterministic, it's too mechanical. Bourdieu would disagree, and he says, no. In one of his formulations, he says, the habitus, listen very carefully now, is the intentionless invention of regulated improvisation, which functions under the laws of conductorless orchestration. Now, such paradoxes, intentionless invention, conductorless orchestration, capture the enigmas of living, moving, interacting in everyday life, where the fact that we don't always know what we're doing suggests that what we do has more meaning than we know. So the point is, we're improvising all the time without being aware of it. That's the point. So translating the enigmas of knowing, doing, and meaning in the dance language of improvisation requires some shifts from Bourdieu's priorities. Susan Foster gets to the heart of the matter when she invokes improvisation's bodily mindfulness, which, quote, summons up a kind of hyper-awareness of the relation between immediate action and overall shape, between that which is about to take place or is taking place and that which has and will take place. Spatiality and temporality are yoked together in a simultaneity of consciousness that is activated not through the generalities of the habitus, for all its sense of le sort de jeu, a feel for the game, the habitus perhaps doesn't quite capture what Paul Carter has described as idiokinetic intuition. Now, the moment we use the language of intuition, I think dancers begin to relax a little bit because they can relate to that more than the habitus, which is more technical. So what is this idiokinetic intuition? Carter says, it's a capacity to intuit directly the nearness of things and to have the measure of them in relation to an almost kaleidoscopic contraction and dilation of movement patterns. Not only does Carter associate this intuition with ball players, who are fabulously intuitive, football, basketball, he also regards it as a condition natural to hunters. So, from ball players to hunters to dancers, how would we begin to posit something like a dancer's habitus? Note that I focus on the dancer rather than dance, because there can be no generalized habitus for dance, but rather deeply individuated and nuanced manifestations of specific embodiments of dance culture. These embodiments are integrally related to particularized systems of training the bodies of dancers. So very simply, the habitus of the dancer is created through a specific training. The body is trained to move in ways that it doesn't move in everyday life. To the extent that almost all dance bodies are the articulations of specific modes of training is the state of truism. But how bodies are trained? In what context? In what conditions? In what constraints? And what are the affective results of this training? Well, this opens up diverse areas of investigation which await an adequate intercultural reading. From ballet to modern dance to non-Western training processes, there are diversities and differences at microkinetic levels, not just across these different schools of dance, but within these schools of dance. Let us engage briefly with non-Western training systems, which are often essentialized and homogenized at so-called pre-expressive levels. The movements of a Balinese dancer, for instance, are molded by the teacher, dancing the movement, as it were, into the dancer's body. The teacher stands behind and literally shapes the movement, molds the movement, sculpts the movement into the dancer's body, literally one-to-one. In Kathakali, the body is formed not only through the daily practice of rigorous eye movements, hastas, mudras, and flexions, but through the mandatory seasonal massage of the dancer's body. So the guru massages the dancers with his feet. The guru unlocking the joints of the body with his feet, each step making the dance body more supple. So the massage, in a sense, becomes a kind of dance and contributes to the training process of the dancer. In Cambodia, as I recently learned from a young dancer trained in the court tradition, she told me that when she made a mistake or stepped out of line, she would be punished by being made to stand in a torturous dance position for an hour on end. A very beautiful dance position, I must say, but it comes out of punishment, you know. So this very literal punishment on the body contributing towards a habitus as a dancer trained in a particular tradition. The intimacies and disciplinary protocols of the guru-shishya parampara in the examples mentioned above, guru, shishya, teacher, student, parampara, tradition, but could be called relationship. This very intimate relationship that exists between teacher and student needs to be contrasted with more mechanized training processes. What happens to the habitus of the dancer when it is denied the intimacies of a body-to-body, person-to-person pedagogical process? In the official regimen imposed on classical Thai dancers, for instance, a regimen which cannot be separated from the demands of cultural tourism and the creative industries, a rigid set of dance movements is repeated mechanically in factory-like training programs. So you have 500 dancers lined up, four teachers, everybody repeating the same thing. In such conditions, one can almost sense that a particular dance body is being cloned, with identical copies emerging from the same DNA, as it were, of a singularized dance system. Now, these coercive, yet apparently self-induced rules and regulations, I should add, do not disappear in more ostensibly democratic regimes of dance in the so-called Western world, where dancers' bodies are also very sharply marked, identified, and shaped through the taxonomies and vocabularies of particular choreographic regimes. Here, the dancer's habitus is so indeed formed that it can extend into body behaviors in everyday life, supplemented by the inflexible laws relating to fitness, which is totally fetishized in the West, and dietary control, which is almost oppressive. It is oppressive. This dance regimen can determine, I would say, not just the dance body, but the very mind and look of the dancer. At this point, let me present a hypothesis to you. And my hypothesis is in the form of a question. What happens to the habitus of dancers when they are assembled from diverse cultures in a particular space. To what extent is the habitus porous, in sync with the mobility of global migration? And to what extent does it lend itself to translation and hybrid practices? Instead of responding to these questions at the level of generality, I'd like to share with you a particular dance-related story, which I really love, and which was shared to me by Cheryl Stock, a choreographer and dance educator based in Brisbane, Australia. In her early career, Cheryl crossed borders in her formative experiments on contemporary dance in Vietnam. Now, there's a real mystique around this category of contemporary dance, you know, which I do believe should not be read as a genre, but more as a method or a modality of exploring the contemporary, which already exists in diverse cultures in extraordinarily textured ways. There is no one overriding sense of the contemporary. We cannot say that Europe or America owns or hegemonizes the idea of the contemporary. Rather, there are several contemporaries which may, in certain contexts, be linked to traditional forms of body knowledge. Chandralekha, the dancer I talk about, was a very contemporary radical woman, but she drew her dance language from Bharatanatyam, from yoga, and from martial arts, but totally in a contemporary way. So this dichotomy that is so stupidly made between tradition and contemporary, I think, really needs to be problematized. In a spirit of intercultural reciprocity, Cheryl invited a male Vietnamese dancer trained in the classical tradition, a man by the name of Pham Anh Phung, to play a pivotal role in a dance piece called Ochre Dusk, a 1990 production, which she was choreographing for Dance North in Sydney. While Anh Phung didn't have much English at that time, which resulted in some communication problems, his dance instinct was so pure and tuned that he faced no misunderstandings with the company. On the final dress rehearsal, his performance was, in Cheryl's description, breathtaking. But on opening night, something inexplicable happened. Anh Phung seemed to slow everything down and drag and stretch his movements so that he seemed to be drowning while the other dancers were working themselves up to a virtuoso crescendo of movements. I will quote from Cheryl to evoke her stunned reaction to what seemed like a sabotage of her work. Quote, "What was he doing? He was ruining my work. My anger got the better of me after the performance. Anh Phung listened as tears streamed down my face. His face was impenetrable, but in his eyes, I thought I could read a mixture of anger, perplexity, and sadness. He said nothing to me except a quiet sorry." Later that night, in between his own sobs, he explained to our administrator, "I slow it down for Cheryl to make more beautiful." Every time I tell this painful story, I tend to choke, because it works totally against the grain of what one has come to expect from the dominant narratives on intercultural misunderstanding. These narratives are marked by the predictable imbalances of power relations, economic inequities, the decontextualization and framing of non-Western material in Eurocentric contexts, and so on. However, this story involving Cheryl Stock and Anh Phung is different, insofar as the intercultural misunderstanding comes out of love for the other. I slow it down for Cheryl to make more beautiful. Now, at one level, it is possible to read the slowing down as an intransigent reflex of Anh Phung's habitus as a dancer trained in a particular system. You can now understand why I spend so much time working on the habitus. This is the habitus, I would say. For all his openness to experiment within the framework of Australian contemporary dance, the slowing down, it could be argued, is part of his dance motor that cannot be eliminated. To this reading, one could add the dimension of aesthetics in relation to producing beauty. I slow it down for Cheryl to make more beautiful. And this making more beautiful is obviously linked to his dance training. But perhaps it is also tempting to read the slowing down as the revelation of a gift. A surprise gift offered to Cheryl on opening night. He didn't do it on the final dress rehearsal. He did it on opening night. It's a surprise gift. Cheryl, this is for you. This is obviously not a gift with a coercive agenda and the demand or expectation of a return. Rather, in a more Derridean sense, it is a gift of the heart, which is beautiful in and of itself. Now, if this seems somewhat too romantic a reading, one could also add that this gift comes not just with heart, but also with protocols. Though An Pung doesn't precisely state why he is giving the gift, it is possible that he has no other option but to do so. This is part of his etiquette as a Vietnamese dancer trained in the classical tradition, where the dancer is expected to regard his performance as an offering. While such offerings in non-Western dance cultures are often read and stereotyped in the context of religiosity, they can also be seen as part of an ethics which underlies aesthetics. And perhaps it is this imbrication of ethics in aesthetics that is probably the most elusive of dance qualities to grasp at an intercultural level. So, was all this lost in translation? I would argue that there was no translation. And more critically, perhaps there is no adequate translation of such embodied affects and intercultural gestures of the gift in dance. This is what makes the moment so painful and yet so beautiful. Now, at this stage in the lecture, I'd like to introduce and problematize the concept of dance citizenship, which at some level would appear to be a regressive maneuver. The nominal concept of citizenship is more often than not linked to the nation state, which in turn has been challenged through new concepts of post-nationalism and global cosmopolitanism, even as the nation state is alive and well, and nationalism seethed virulently in almost every part of the world. It would appear that under the lure of cosmopolitanism, as if all dancers on the move are global citizens, when in actuality, many of them could be denied the basic rights of citizens in terms of medical care, housing, and employment as dancers. At a time when there are millions of stateless people, refugees, and asylum seekers living in wretched conditions of uncertainty and immobility. They cannot move, they're stuck in certain places, maybe for years and years on end. I wouldn't be so cynical about citizenship. For these individuals, nothing could be more reassuring than the certainty of a passport. We who have the privilege to cross borders tend to take our mobility and passports for granted. Don't take your mobility or passports for granted. I became aware of citizenship at a visceral and creative level through my close observation of third sector citizenship and civil society movements in Brazil from the early 1990s onwards. On my first trip, which took me to a Candomblé center in a shanty town out on the outskirts of Rio de Janeiro, I was entranced by the vibrant dancing of the white-skirted priestesses of this Yoruba Afro-Brazilian cult of worship, the swirling movements of the women building towards a communitas of ecstasy. It was beautiful. But I was also puzzled as to why such an intense form of corporeal spirituality needed to link itself to a citizenship movement. I remember asking my Beate, the matriarch of the center, this very question. I said, Mother, why, of course, through a translator, why are you part of this citizenship movement, this third sector movement? What I saw before me at that point was not an incarnation of an Orisha, a goddess, but a black working class woman. Holding herself upright, she said, "I want to be recognized as a citizen." To which I responded with another question, "What does a citizen mean to you, mother?" She said, "A citizen is," and her voice trailed a bit, and then she said, "When I enter a hospital, they don't turn me out because I'm black." I learned a lot from that moment, notably the fact that your immersion in spiritual energy and dance doesn't necessarily guarantee you fundamental rights. Dance citizenship is a concept and practice that has been initiated by Ivaldo Bertazzo, a therapist, yoga exponent, choreographer, and dance educator, who has extended his concept of citizenship through dance to the most deprived youth of Brazilian society, living in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo, where he is based. Observing his dance practice, I noticed that his philosophy of movement has been distilled into what could be called biomechanics, where primary movements of the body relating to balance, concentration, focus, and coordination are repeated in incremental cycles of repetitive movement. To be noted is the fact that unlike the dance philosophy of, say, Aaron Manning, which is implicitly structured around a couple, this is something that Manning doesn't quite problematize. A movement is linked to the figure of two, and generally it's a woman to a woman. She never quite problematizes gender or sexuality. And the bodies of this couple, of course, multiply and mutate, as I mentioned earlier. Bertazzo is not working with a couple. He's working with a multitude of dancers who share the same space. There are some possible traps here. And I turn to Manning because she's so alert in her language. She says, "The politics of touch departs from Aristotelian thought. In my turn towards another, I engage with the very potentiality of extending myself, of challenging myself to feel the presence and absence of that other. Aristotle, on the other hand, would argue that every gesture performed by a citizen, a man, is preordained towards the potentiality of inaugurating a polis, or a plurality of like-minded individuals." In contrast, I would say, in Bertazzo's workshops, where there are as many women as there are men, the overall goal is not to acquire homogeneity, but to imbibe what I would describe as a highly tuned, physicalized, and individuated heterogeneity of living together. Not every form of repetitive mass movement, I would argue, needs to lead inexorably to like-minded uniformity, nor should one jump too quickly into assuming that all forms of mass movement are embryonic fascist spectacles. What makes a crucial difference here is the activation of critical reflexivity, which is something that is urgently needed in the world of dance, critical thinking, where dance is constantly juxtaposed with grassroots critical theory. Bertazzo's psychophysical training is communicated through actual dance practice, not by professional dancers, this is important, but by community workers and social activists steeped in Paulo Freire's pedagogy of the oppressed. It's unbelievable. This is something you can't imagine, that people who are steeped in Paulo Freire are dancing, you know. Unlike political activists in countries like India, who are tacitly or rigidly opposed to any form of incorporating the body into the political process. And this is so strange because India is a very physical country. It's a very sensuous country. We have a very vital public culture. There's no inhibition as such. But yet when it comes to politics, the political ideologues, the activists, especially on the left, are somewhat wary of the body. And I would say they have a very puritanical approach to the body. They don't accept the sensuality of the body as being part of politics. The situation is very different in Brazil. Maybe it has something to do with the national popular culture of Brazil, which is, you know, has embraced football, samba, carnival, which is so important, and where there is a certain libidinal investment in the body. There are no hang-ups about sexuality. as, or let's say, the fewer hang-ups about sexuality that exist in many other parts of the world. So there's a greater openness here to the potentiality of the body in questioning and reimagining the body politic as a palpable reality. Any process of social transformation, I would affirm, needs supplements and alliances. Dance can ignite the process of transformation, but if we wish to move beyond the micro-political into the wider domain of public culture, then it does become necessary to draw on the inputs of social movements and alternative ecological practices. You know, when we went to see that wonderful center in the buffer zone between the two parts of the island here, and I realized that kind of initiative is actually very, very interesting because it's working across sectors. It's on the one working through dance, it's working through education, it's working through rewriting history. All of these things are coming together in new collaborative forms. This is exciting. Just as I had indicated early in this lecture, the need to sensitize ourselves to ethics in aesthetics, we also need more dialogue and collaboration across cultural and social sectors for which new creative infrastructures and mediations are needed. Now, when I use words like new creative infrastructures and mediations, I realize that I could be echoing the official language of the ideologues promoting creative industries. And all I would say at this point, what makes my position different, is I feel these infrastructures have to be created by artists. It's artists who have to lead these creative infrastructures, not bureaucrats. Do not trust the creativity of bureaucrats, it's missing. So in my concluding reflection, I would assert in a more personal and direct level to you here that the process of transformation has to begin where? Where you are. As dancers, you don't have to be in Berlin or New York or London, where in actuality any real possibility of transforming the systems in place poses huge challenges. In less capital-intensive systems, such as the one that exists right here, there could be more room for creative intervention. And the role of the amateur and the non-professional need not be so summarily derided. I think it's in this kind of a space, actually, that a process of transformation could really begin, but only with the realization, and I'm speaking very specifically to you here in Cyprus, only with the realization that the border is not just out there. There are all kinds of borders which proliferate around us, not just political borders, but those created by poverty, exclusion, and most of all, indifference. We need to attune ourselves to the borders that we carry within us, borders that prevent us from acting and reaching towards the other. In my few days in Cyprus, I see a lot of vacant spaces. And in those vacant spaces, I often see the bodies of foreign workers from many different parts of the world, like Bangladesh and so on. Have you, living here in Cyprus, have you ever recognized foreign workers as humans? Have you ever looked them in the eye? Have you recognized them? Have you talked to them? Or have you just walked past them? And I'm actually trying to say, if you just begin by opening your eyes to them and seeing them, as I am seeing you, you're crossing the border. So, out of such infinitesimal border crossings, for which you don't need a visa, you don't need a passport, you need to move your eye, I do believe that new bodies can be envisioned, which need not be perpetually deferred in a utopian postponement of a democracy to come. Rather, I believe that these bodies can resonate in the here and now, incorporating the tensions of everyday life into new possibilities of social transformation. Thank you.